Hello and welcome to the very first Irish Times Culture Podcast. I'm Irish Times Arts Editor Shane Hegarty. In the studio today we have Irish Times journalist Rosita Boland. Hello, Rosita.
Hi, Shane.
We have Irish Times columnist Fintan O'Toole. Hello.
Hi,
Fintan. And we have award-winning, double award-winning Irish Times blogger Jim Carroll.
Hello, Shane.
What do you do with the awards?
Are they... Well, one is on the mantelpiece and one is apparently in Dundalk.
One is apparently in Dundalk?
Apparently in Dundalk.
Has it been stolen and melted down for...
Damien Mully, the organiser, took him somewhere and I'm supposed to get him back to him. He said he left him in Dundalk, in the train in Dundalk.
There you go. Well, we're going to talk about three kind of interesting things today, partly perhaps linked by their age and possible extinction. And the first one is going to be, we should talk about Record Store Day first, because you're going to be writing about this for the Irish Times, Jim, on Saturday.
Yeah, Record Store Day happens on Saturday week on April 16th. It's a worldwide celebration of the record store. It was put together by some American record store owners to highlight the fact that, I suppose, people had stopped, got out of the habit of going to record shops and got out of the habit, especially, of going to independent record shops to buy their music. I mean, it's a worldwide trend. We see it here in Ireland, record shops closing down all the time. Since last year's Record Store Day, we've seen Comet, Road Records, CD Discs, Zhivago in Galway, BPM in Waterford and Wexford, and Redline in Galway closed down. People just aren't buying records anymore. There's an awful lot of commercial pressure on record store owners as well in terms of rates, rent, and also, like, it really has become a niche thing, you said in the introduction, you know, that we can remember, I suppose, all of us around the table here of a certain vintage, we can remember when going to record shops is the only way you can get music. In the last 10 years, especially, has not become true at all. You can actually get music on your smartphone. You can get music when you go home on your laptop. People just don't need to go to record shops anymore. And the record shops haven't really helped their cause either, you know. I mean, they've been stymied, I suppose, by high prices. They've been stymied as well by, I suppose, a lack of stock. You know, a physical shop means it can't have sort of width and depth of a catalogue that you can get from someone like Amazon or someone like Play Online.
When was the last time you bought a CD?
Oh, see, things. I'm a nerd. I bought CDs the last two weekends ago in New York. I tend to buy CDs and often when I'm away. There's a great shop in New York called Other Music. There's a great shop in Barcelona called CD Drome. There's Rough Trade in London. The thing is, when I go into those shops, I actually said to my wife, I was really disappointed when I came out of Other Music, because it's the first time I came out of Other Music without spending $100. It was like suddenly the stuff wasn't there, you know. But it's like in terms of Irish record shops, I haven't been to an Irish record shop in, I suppose, last time I went in was CD Discs when it was closing down in February, and just to kind of like say best of luck to the owners, you know. But like the thing is, like, that was the first time I've been in there in 6 months.
But that was the thing. I mean, Fintan, I should ask you, when was the last time you bought a CD?
Like Jim, the last time I bought a lot of CDs was in Toronto a few months ago, because I think there are still great record stores, but I don't think you've got them in Dublin, at least where I live. And I think you really miss it. Like the thing about a shop that's different from buying online, of course, is what you get in a good shop is the stuff you didn't know you wanted. You know, if online is brilliant for finding exactly what it is you want, that stuff you've been obsessed with, and getting it reasonably efficiently. But record stores are for wasting time. You know, just like the great bookshops are. You know, for browsing, for dawdling, for loitering with intent. You know, and for finding stuff and looking at it and saying, "Geez, this looks really interesting."
But I find I get that online now. If you go into something like Hype Machine, you can spend a huge amount of time just bouncing from music blog to music blog to music blog, finding things that you didn't think you'd like, remixes, cover versions, new music. And
there's a social aspect to the actual browsing in a bricks and mortar shop as well that Fintan is talking about. You know, that there's other nerds like you in there. Yes, there are other nerds online as well, but you can't see them. And also, because you're online, you don't know if they're dogs or if they're actually human beings. You know, but when you're in an actual physical shop, it's that thing about when you've got good staff in the shop. I've lost count of the number of times and the amount of money I've spent in shops when a record store clerk said to me, "Oh, I see you're buying the Beachwood Sparks record. Well, I think you might like this." You know, and that interaction, we'll definitely miss that. We won't miss rude staff. We won't miss badly stocked shops, but we'll miss that sort of interaction when you had the kind of a fellow nerd behind the counter who's willing to push you in certain directions. Okay, we'll get that online, but I suppose that social interaction when a lot of bookshops were closing, like me back in January, when, hey, Waterstones went out of business, that was one thing people were kind of talking about, that lack of a social interaction.
It is, Rosita, one of those. You can see the parallel now in terms of bookstores, because bookstores are closing globally and increasingly locally. And I mean, I can, again, from a personal point of view, I downloaded 4 or 5 books last year, so I can't complain now when bookstores go out of business. Could you see yourself downloading solely? Will you miss the bookstore?
I suppose I don't really, I would sometimes buy books from Amazon or other places, but they're still real physical books. I haven't yet downloaded any books. Like Fintan was saying, you know, what I love about bookshops is you don't know what you want or what you're intrigued by until you actually go in there and you see the choice. And there's places like Charlie Burns in Galway is my favourite bookshop, because, you know, that's a kind of a cabinet of curiosities. You never know what you're going to get. And if you're trying to buy something online, you have to know in advance what you want. And I think that's sort of the missing element, as well as the, you know, talking to staff who actually know what they're selling. I mean, that's the big difference when you're online. It's just you and your own information, and you don't have the benefit of other people's knowledge, really. And that's what I do miss already. And, you know, I still go to bookshops, though, and I try and buy an independent bookshop. So I think that's important, because if we want them to survive, we have to support them.
That's the thing about, certainly in terms of record stores, that while people talk about, you know, Road Records was the big case in point, that people wanted it to survive, but the market decides whether it survive, whether a record store survives, and ultimately sentiment isn't going to pay anybody.
Of course. I mean, and the other thing as well on that point was that people always used to maintain that you needed record shops to maintain a healthy, vibrant eco-culture as well, among bands. That bands needed the shops to survive in order to sell the music. But I mean, last year was an amazing year for Irish music. There was over 200 releases, album releases. All the record shops closed down. The releases kept coming. They kept coming. You know, that's trying to turn out to be a bit false. You know, and it's the thing is, like, you know, we all would like to support great record shops. I'd love if there was a great independent record shop like Rough Trade or Other Music here in Dublin. But there's not, because the market, as you say, isn't there to support it. You know, we haven't got the big population. We think of ourselves as a big music city in Dublin. There's lots of gigs happening in Dublin. So you would kind of like think that, okay, in that case, there should be lots of great record shops. But there's not. You know, contrast that with someone like Groningen in Holland, where I go every January for the Eurosonic Festival. It's a small college town in the north of Holland, and it's like it's got six incredible record shops, like six amazing record shops in which I spend a lot of money every January. But like, it's a town that I mean, can you name a band from Groningen?
Don't ask me. You ask me this every week. No, I still can't name a band from Groningen. Yeah. Anyway, from one dying format to 100 dying formats, possibly. Fintan, you've been working on 100 objects, History of Ireland and 100 objects. I think you're in the Irish Times every Saturday. You're at number 6, would that be right?
I think, yeah, we'll be at number 7 on Saturday, which is the only one that's really hard to photograph because it's a 15-metre long dugout canoe, which is in the National Museum. A lot of people have seen it. It's an extraordinary object, but it's the biggest problem we've had with the series so far, because it's very hard to get it into a photograph because of the sheer length of it. But there's a great picture of it coming into the National Museum in 1902 when it was dug up from a bog in County Galway. And they had to bring it into the gates of Leinster House because it's just so large and it's been plonked there. But I mean, the idea for this really, it's like, you know, those folk singers I always love, because he says, well, I learned this off Christy Moore records, you know. Well, the idea for this came directly, it was a complete rip-off from something that the British Museum did and Radio 4, where Neil McGregor did a History of the World in 100 Objects. And of course, you can do that with the British Museum because they've got this astonishing collection. But it did strike me that, you know, you could do actually something quite different in the Irish context, because it's, we have a more intimate relationship with a smaller number of objects which tell a more discreet kind of history, really, the history of this island. And there were really just a couple of very simple perceptions with it. I mean, one is that I think our culture has lost a sense of chronology. You know, people often actually find it very hard to say, well, you know, did the Normans come after the Vikings or before the Vikings? You know, I think the way history has been taught is much more exciting very often, but sometimes just that basic backbone of this happened after this has been lost. But the other thing is that, you know, we are in very, very tough times, and we've got this incredible resource in terms of the National Museum, but also other local museums and institutions around the country, which have free access. And we have a great cultural tradition in this country, which you sometimes forget, of free access to this stuff. It belongs to us. And it is very, very exciting. And some of the stuff, I have to confess, you know, I'd seen it before, but I'd never really looked at it properly. Like there's a mace head from Knowth, for example, that we looked at. You know, that's over 5,000 years old. And you look at it and you think, how was this possibly made? The technology involved is absolutely astonishing, because the finesse of this work on really, really hard stone, and you think, hold on, Stone Age people shouldn't have been able to make this. And so often these objects themselves are some of the greatest works of art we actually have in Ireland. Sometimes they're not works of art at all, but each one of them has a story to tell. And I think through relating the objects to the bigger narrative, you get some sense of how people lived, what they thought, and how they imagined the world around them.
I thought briefly you were going to suggest, when you talked about this great resource we have at hard times, we might sell the things and make some money back. What's the criteria for... I mean, I'd wondered, for instance, could you include a building? Could you include the Anglo-Irish Bank building, which is half built on Dublin's Docklands at the moment?
Well, if you're going to do 100 objects, we actually had to come up with some limiting criteria, and one of those was to exclude buildings, because you could do a whole other series, and maybe it's a really good idea, you know, it's a history of Ireland and 100 buildings, I think would be fascinating. So we had to define an object, first of all, as a single entity, right? So it's a thing. It has to be humanly made, right? So it's a thing that's been made by people. It has to be something that is representative in some way, so that it actually allows us to tell a larger story. And the other criterion is simply that there's public access to it. So there is stuff that is fascinating, but if people can't go and see it, it probably takes away the point of the series. You know, one of the things you'd hope with this is that people would look at something, say, God, this is really interesting, and then if they're around town, or if they're, you know, in reasonable proximity to wherever the object is, they might pop in and have a look at it, spend 10 minutes looking at it. And I think that's already been happening. People in the National Museum have been telling me that, you know, a lot of people have been wandering in and saying, where's that thing that was in the Irish Times last Saturday? And I think that's good, because it's something you can do, costs you nothing, and does enrich people's sense of their own past. And, you know, without being sort of too heavy about it, I think we have a kind of crisis of identity as well in Ireland at the moment. You know, we're really pretty screwed up in relation to what does it mean to be Irish and all that stuff. And, you know, re-engaging somewhat with these objects, which give you some sense of how people made lives on this island over very, very long periods of time, usually in circumstances much more difficult than our own, perhaps allows us to get some sense that there is something beyond the hole that we're living in at the moment.
Rosita, is there anything in particular you would put into the 100 objects?
I think it's at Collins Barracks, and it's a hurling ball made of hair, and they were tokens that women used to make to when they were either newly married. They'd give them as love tokens to men, and they'd be used in the hurling matches on May Day. And I just think that this kind of a wonderfully esoteric, marvellous... it's kind of a piece of social history, and it, you know, it's just fascinating. I always find myself going and having a look at that, and, you know, thinking about the women who must have held it in their hands, and then, you know, what happened to them afterwards. And probably very few of them survived, because, you know, they would have been whacked to pieces, really. But there is a great surviving one at Collins Barracks.
But I think you touched on it there, really, that you wrote about this in the introduction to the series, Fintan, that it is about that sense of human contact, isn't it? That you could at first say it's a very reductive thing to take these objects and very narrowly focus on them, but it is that sense that they have passed through human hands, which makes them so special.
I think that's absolutely true. You know, there's certainly a danger of fetishizing things as opposed to people, but we do live in a digital culture, and we're very used to the simulacrum. You know, the thing that reminds you of the real thing and that sometimes becomes almost indistinguishable from the real thing. And there's just something still incredibly moving about the idea that this object, as Rosita was saying, was handled by, was made by people very, very like ourselves, whom we do not know about, but also was seen by, you know, generations of people, had significance for them, had some sort of magic in itself. And I think you just come back to the very simple thing, and maybe it's just me, I'm of a certain age and didn't grow up in a digital culture, but I always know if I go to a museum and you see an object and then you see a little thing saying, this is not the real object, this is a copy, it feels wrong. It feels like it's a different thing. And why is that? Well, maybe it is a bit of a kind of fetishization thing, but it's what the actual object has that the copy doesn't have, is that sense of having been physically made, physically seen, physically present throughout eras of history that are both very, very like our own, because people don't change that much, and also circumstances that are very different from our own.
So, well, before we move on, Jim, did you have anything in particular?
I've been trying to think of anything, and aside from kind of a copy of Peg, nothing else comes to mind. But I mean, what fascinates me about it, and you kind of touched on there, Finn, is the fact that these objects were made by I suppose our ancestors, but they remained hidden for so long. Like, I mean, the stories behind how these pieces were actually found as well is quite amazing, and the fact that they all stayed in public ownership, that like someone didn't kind of like decide, oh, well, I found the Darien de Flan shells, I'm going to put this in my bag, I'm going to go to Canada, I'm going to flog it. You know, I find that's really interesting as well. And sometimes it's the stories as well about how these pieces came to be in the museum, which are quite fascinating.
Well, but as I said, one of the most recent examples was found in a skip a couple of years ago, isn't that right?
Well, that's right. The Coggle Bag Hoard is a fantastic story. You know, it was just that there was a robbery in a chemist shop. Some gougers from Dublin robbed a chemist shop. They took the stuff back. There was a little envelope, and they just dumped it because they thought there was nothing in it. And so it ended up in a skip in Dublin. The family realised, because their father had this thing, and they realised that it was actually some very old gold. But you see, it was so thin. The photographs don't often show you this. The stuff was beaten gold, and it's very, very thin. It only weighed about 2 ounces. So the guys didn't really know there was anything in it. So the Gardaí heroically waded into the skip. They got it just a couple of hours before it was going to be the skip was going to be lifted and it was going to be dumped. You know, so this could have been lost, and it was actually found. And what was found was, the objects in themselves are fantastic but not unique, but the assembly of those objects, so the fact that you had this gold collar and two gold discs coming together, completely changes what archaeologists thought about these objects, because previously they thought, well, the gold discs are much older than the collars, so they were never actually used together. Here you had them all found together and obviously used together. And this is the great thing, that this story keeps changing. So what the meaning of these objects is never closed. It's changing as new knowledge comes into play.
Well, look, I promised myself I wouldn't use this lazy link, but I'm going to do it anyway, which is from one bunch of dusty artefacts in an expensive national institution to Estonia, where Rosita spent her day yesterday. I apologise, Rosita. You were at the Estonia General Assembly on Monday. It's a public, in the afternoon it's public. You were the only journalist there, and they spent an inordinate amount of time talking about gardening. Explain.
Well, it's the annual General Assembly, the morning session. It's traditionally closed. That's when they elect the new members. Then in the afternoon, it's open to the public. And I suppose I was fairly astonished that, I appear to be the only journalist there, and there was no members of the public. And in fact, they had to run around and find somewhere for me to sit. So I don't know what they would have done if more people would have turned up. So I think there's just two things. Like, one is, I'm really astonished that there weren't members of the public there, because I attended the arts hustings, you know, before the election, which was in the Project Arts Centre. That was packed capacity. They turned away 200 people on the day. There was huge interest in that. So I was just wondering, where is this community of people who are interested in the arts, who work in the arts? Estonia represents artists in all disciplines and genres, and you know, every artist is concerned about money and the future of funding, and all of these things of concern the wider arts community. So I'm just amazed as to why there wasn't a single member of the public there, or anybody interested in arts communities. I don't know why that is.
But isn't this the thing about Estonia at the moment, that it's an institution which is seen as important for both recognition of artists and for some of them financially, although people like Joseph O'Connor have become members of yesterday, and they don't have to take up the money that's given to them. But that, when you look at the last year and a half, and you look at what the National Campaign for the Arts has done here, really putting the arts on the political agenda. On the back, it has to be said, of Farmley, which was very important for that. Estonia's voice in all of this hasn't been loud. As a sense of what is its relevance, that there's always a question of how artistically relevant some of the people are once, or certainly a few years after they get in. But for an organisation which has always strived to make itself politically relevant, it hasn't been particularly relevant of late.
Well, obviously we don't know what happens in the closed session, so we don't know what the members discuss in the morning, but it does seem that they're perhaps an introspective community that are, you know, that it's peer election, and they're, from what I heard, there didn't seem to be an awful lot about, you know, the wider kind of interaction or engagement with the wider artistic community. And I mean, one of the motions, there were a few motions passed. I always thought a motion was very short, some of these amounted to speeches. But the most esoteric one was by Margareta Darcy, who's a playwright and novelist. And she proposed that Eas Thona members lobby the Minister Quinn to include gardening as part of the curriculum for schools. And, you know, there was a lengthy discussion of about 20 minutes about the merits of gardening from many of the members. And the original motion had focused, I think, exclusively on gardening. It was widened to include drama and writing and, you know, more, I suppose, traditional arts activities within schools. But the fact it was discussed really so seriously for the best part of 20 minutes of, you know, an hour and a half, an hour and 45 minutes. I just thought that was interesting. It said something quite esoteric about, you know, people's focus and interest on that day.
And Fintan, do you have any, where do you see Estona standing in terms of its importance in the arts in Ireland?
Well, I think, you know, when Estona was established, there were really kind of two separate goals for it, I think. One of them was to just look to honour people of achievement in the arts. And I think it does that. You know, we don't have an honour system in Ireland. It is actually quite important that there are, particularly for those who are perhaps less well-known. You know, there's a lot of people there who have massive international reputations and perhaps don't need it. But there's a lot of people who actually just need the validation to say, look, I'm a member of Estona, I'm honoured by my country. And I think it should always do that. It's lovely to see someone like John Arden, for example, yesterday being embraced as an Irish artist because he's been here for so long. But, you know, Arden is one of the great playwrights of the last 50 years.
82, we should say.
He's contributed hugely to the cultural life in Ireland and actually hasn't been much honoured previously here. So that role is I think, very valuable. I think there was also an ambition that that Estona would be some sort of like the Académie Française or some sort of, you know, conglomeration of these great creative minds which would then contribute to public debate in Ireland. And I think it's failed completely on that score. I mean, I actually can't really remember any moment during its history when Estona has made a really significant intervention in public debate in Ireland. All of the controversies around Estona have been to do with membership or to do with, you know, rows around, say, Francis Stewart or whatever, but they've been very internalised, as Rosita was saying, you know, that the focus seems to be very, very internal. And maybe it's impossible. Maybe we just don't have an intellectual tradition in Ireland in which artists see it as being part of their role collectively to contribute to public debate. But you would have thought at a moment of crisis in Ireland when there is really serious public distress around, you know, who do we look to for some kind of moral or ethical or spiritual guidance, you would have thought that an Assembly of Irish Artists would have something to say.
And curiously, a lot of foreign press have looked to our writers. John Banville, Colm Tobin have contributed widely. So it's not as if there isn't an opportunity there, there isn't a voice that can be tapped into. Okay, well, we'll move on from that. And before we wrap up, Jim, you are Adele has been your big thing over the last couple of weeks. Adele is in town next week.
She's in town next playing Tuesday in the Olympia. Gigs sold out. Gigs been sold out since tickets went on sale. And I wrote a piece about her on the blog this week, and I didn't mention the gig for the simple reason I'd forgotten she was playing or didn't even realise she was playing. It's because there's been no constant reminder by the press, by the record label or by the promoter about the gig, because there's been no need to. The gig's it's sold out. It's a phenomenal what she's done. It's phenomenal on her second album, 21. She's broken all kinds of records. She's sold more records than Madonna, similar stage. She's reaching up to Bob Marley and the Wailers' Legend album in terms of weeks number one. She's broken some records that the Beatles held. I mean, she's a 21-year-old girl from East London with an amazing set of pipes and these brilliant songs. And she's got a great kind of, I suppose, light touch record label and management situation behind her. It's worked really well. But what's really worked is that she's got these songs that touch people. I mean, I was looking at the midweek charts from Ireland just for over Mother's Day in terms of albums being sold, and Mary Byrne has sold 11,000 copies in Tesco alone, so I mean that's obvious. But Adele is still selling huge amounts of records. She's going to be number two in the charts next week, and this is remarkable on, I suppose, two scores. One, the album's out 3 months, which is, and for it to be still selling this kind of numbers is phenomenal. And second of all, it's also a case that, like, it's a new artist as such. It's only her second album, and that's quite noteworthy.
When what night she's
playing Tuesday night in Olympia,
right? But no tickets available.
No tickets available.
All right, but the album as well. well worth
it. Album's well worth investigating.
Look, I'm going to wrap it up there. Thank you very much, each of you, Rosita, Fintan and Jim, for being part of the very first Irish Times Culture podcast. We hope to be back again next week. You can read us in the Irish Times newspaper every day in Life and Culture, or you can come and read us online at irishtimes.com/culture, or you can find me, Shane Hegarty, on Twitter. Until next week, goodbye.